It's a pleasure for me to sit in for Bill Arnold this afternoon and talk with the great guests that come across this program on a regular basis. One of those honored to talk to is Abdu Murray, who's a North American director with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, author of several books, including Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. And we're going to learn about his journey. He was, for most of his life, a proud Muslim, studied the Quran and Islam, and then began a search that led to faith in Christ. And he speaks on campuses. In fact, maybe your kids are heading back to a university campus where Abdu has perhaps done some campus forums with Ravi Zacharias and others, and we'll find out what that's like. Abdu, welcome to Faith Radio. Good to have you back on.
It's great to be on, Neil. Thanks for having me on. I love being on the show.
You know, want to just have you maybe tell a bit about your story again, because it was a pretty... I guess maybe long by our standards, maybe not. But I mean, were you a serious seeker, or in terms of Christianity, or just world religions? Is that what prompted your interest in faith?
Actually, it started off as me being a little bit on the close-minded side. Believe it or not, I had this, which is not a close-minded view, that certain things are true, and my perspective doesn't matter. In other words, things are true even if people don't believe them, or if they do. And so I thought Islam was true, and I was engaging with Christians. Actually, you know, it was Christian because they were sort of low hanging fruit in my area where I grew up. And but I was an equal opportunity sort of faith knocker outer upper. There was, you know, there were atheists, Jews, Hindus, you know, Buddhists here or there. Not very many, but there were a couple. But for the most part, it was Christians I was talking to about why I thought they were wrong and why Islam was right. And one of the reasons why I thought Christianity was wrong was because I had this strong sense of if God exists, then he must be the greatest possible being, which is why Muslims say the phrase Allahu Akbar. It literally means God is greater. And so God's greatness is the single most important idea in Islam. And I thought Christianity actually insulted God's greatness. So I thought ideas like the Trinity and the incarnation of God in Christ and the cross were all insulting ideas. And so I made it my mission to sort of debunk those ideas for Christians. Now, I didn't do it, you know, in a mean or combative way. I would just engage in casual conversation. And over time, issues of God would come up, and I would begin to tell Christians why they were wrong and I was right. You know, a funny thing happened on the way to the mosque, as it were. I met some Christians who actually knew what they were talking about. Now, unfortunately, at that time, there were a few, a blessed few, but they were still few. But they got me thinking about Christianity, and I began to look at things, not because I had an open mind towards whether they were true or not. At first, it was just I wanted to make sure that I understood Christianity so I could debunk it. I didn't want to debunk the fake thing. I wanted to debunk the real thing. And along the way, as I began to encounter Christians who not only could answer my objections, but had a few objections of their own, I began to see this isn't so stupid after all. And that actually made me uncomfortable because oftentimes, and I say this quite often when I give my testimony or I talk about any worldview, whether it's atheism or Eastern religions or Islam or whatever, whenever you're faced with a contrary worldview and that worldview starts to seem credible, that becomes incredibly uncomfortable because what we want is not truth. What we want is comfort as human beings. We want to be validated. That's why we all have confirmation bias. We look at evidence in a way that confirms our own views, even if that evidence is contrary to our view. But I began to see the gospel was not only contradicting my worldview as a Muslim, but it was also credible. So it was a contradictory, competing, and credible worldview, and that became extremely uncomfortable for me because I didn't want to change who I was. I liked being who I was. I lived a good life, and I didn't smoke, drink, do drugs. I didn't have sex before marriage kind of a thing, none of that stuff. I was a good Muslim. I liked being Muslim. It was part of who I was, and the gospel was beckoning me to die to all that and to embrace Christ as Lord, and I just didn't want to do it. So as the evidence began to mount, my discomfort began to grow until I saw something, and it was this credibility, not just of the gospel in general, but of the specific points that I thought were the worst points. I thought the Trinity was silly. I thought the incarnation was wrong and insulting. I thought the cross was the ultimate humiliation for God. Why would I believe in a God like that? that have begun to see the Trinity, the incarnation, and the cross, are not things that insult God's greatness, but the very things that demonstrate God's greatness.
Powerful story. A good reminder for us too, and maybe we'll talk about it in a bit. How do we become Christians who know what they're talking about? And that's what you've kind of given your life to here for many years, serving with Ravi. I'm curious. You were talking about your experience in Islam. I think just last week or so, it was emphasis on the Hajj, making the pilgrimage to Mecca. Have you ever? Was that something that you felt called to do, or what is that it's a requirement, yeah. I guess one of the five requirements, isn't it?
Yeah, there's actually two versions of the Hajj. There's the main Hajj, and then there's the a smaller non-compulsory version. There's an optional one, but there's a compulsory one. And what we just experienced was a holiday called Adha, which is Eid al-Adha, is a holiday where Muslims commemorate the attempted sacrifice by Abraham of his eldest son. That story actually is in the Quran, where Abraham takes his son up a mountain. They think it's Ishmael. The Bible says it's Isaac. But they do, in fact, celebrate that Abraham was willing to obey God and sacrifice his son. But in the story in the Quran, the God stops Abraham from killing his son and instead provides what the Quran says, a momentous sacrifice, or God ransomed his son with a momentous sacrifice, and there's a ram caught in a thicket or some kind of an animal. So Muslims actually do a pilgrimage, and they will commemorate this by slaughtering an animal in order to sort of commemorate what Abraham did, which, by the way, is incidentally, is a great bridge-building point for Christians and Muslims, because we share that story in common. And the question we always have to ask Muslims is, why did God ransom Abraham's son? Why was a ransom provided at all? It was merely a test of faith to see if Abraham would do it. Why provide the ransom? Why even call it a ransom, as the Quran does? And that would get us to a great discussion of the fact that God provides a ransom not just for Abraham's son, but for all of us. It was a foreshadowing of what was to come. But that's an aside and a little point of contact we can have with our Muslim friends. As a Muslim, I did feel called to want to do the Hajj. I converted to Christianity, and I began my journey, actually, and had my feelings about the credibility of the gospel in my 20s. I became a Christian at age 27, and so never really had either the financial means or the opportunity to actually go. At that particular moment, when I converted, I didn't go, but it was something that I was called to do, and many people I love and know have gone on the Hajj.
You know, say more about those opportunities for building bridges. Yes, I mean, we certainly don't have to argue about whose son it was, what son it was, Abraham. But to talk about that sacrificial, lamb or ram, are there other bridge building opportunities that you've found that we could easily take on as a means of conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my second book, Grand Central Question, tries to do this, something like this, between atheism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and Eastern religions, and Islam, and takes each one of those and says, how do we find common ground upon which to talk? Now, I used already the analogy of bridge building, but I want to be careful, because oftentimes I think that when you use bridge building, we refer to two-way streets, like, because conversion runs one way. But so I often like to use the word platform. We find the common platform upon which we can stand. And we look at the various pools we can jump off into. Some pools have no water. Only one pool has all the water. So we got to figure out which one that is. But I think the way to do that with Muslims, for example, is that foundational issue of God's greatness, like I mentioned before. Muslims believe in God's greatness, and so do Christians. We believe that God's greatness is unsearchable, to quote Psalm 145. So I think this is a common platform, so we can say we both believe God is great, but which worldview actually justifies that greatness? So one common area I think that we have where we can begin to discuss is the idea that God is eternal, and he is uncreated, and also he's relational. So he's eternal, uncreated, and relational. And Muslims believe that, and so do Christians. But the problem is this. Muslims believe in a God who is Unitarian. He is one in his nature and one in his person. But if he's uncreated and he's relational and everything else was created, then when God was alone, he was incapable of being relational. There was no way for him to be relational. He would need to create something else to be who he is. The Trinity actually solves that issue, because the Trinity teaches us that God isn't just one in his nature and one in his person. He is one in his nature. There is one being who shares three consciousnesses or three minds, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, each one loving the other from eternity. The uncreated being exists in a state of uncreated love, always an uncreated relationship. So he never needs to create anything to be relational. He always has a relationship within himself. And if he doesn't need anything, then he is truly great. And that's what we can share with our Muslim friends. That's but one example of the many.
Good word from Abdu Murray, talking about one of his books, Grand Central Question, and looking for some platforms for which to stand and to begin conversation with as we look to share the reality of who Jesus is and the reality of God's greatness. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about Abdu's work on campuses across the country, around the globe, actually. He is the North American Director of the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, and has just been recently doing some campus forums. I'm interested in finding out what it's like on campus today, and are the questions the same as they were maybe 10 years ago? We'll hear more from Abdu Murray in just a moment. Seven past the hour. It's the afternoon show. Bill Arnold, I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in, talking with Abdu Murray today from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries and author of several books, including his latest, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. I know, Abdu, you were recently doing another campus forum. I'm interested in kind of what happens at an event like that, and is your goal to bring about the discomfort, as you talked about in your own journey, that uncomfortableness once you begin to hear more about a different worldview.
Yeah, and that is part of it. It's to make essentially the gospel credible, and while it's discomforting, and it's supposed to be, not overtly so, or not overly so, I should say. I think one of the things about apologetics people often say is that what are you so sorry about when you're being apologetic? Obviously, that's not the connotation. but I think the way some folks have done apologetics is they've engaged in the art of making somebody sorry they asked. Because we just sort of hit them over the head with all these facts and figures and make them like lose an argument. The goal of RZIM is helping the thinker believe and the believer think. And what we want to do, essentially, our strategy is, you can follow it with Blaise Pascal actually says. He says, the men despise religion because they fear that it may be true. The cure for this is to show that religion is not contrary to reason, but worthy of reverence, respect. Next, make it attractive. Make good people wish it were true, and then show them that it is. That's a hard thing to do, because oftentimes when you go to a college campus, they don't want it to be true. They want it to be false. They want a caricature of Christianity. They want to sort of blend either conservatism or republicanism or whatever it might be with evangelicalism. And there's all this baggage and trapping that goes alongside of it. And we're there to present the mere gospel, the straight-up gospel. And the trappings that go around it, you can work out eventually, but we're there to provide it with the gospel itself and try to make it as attractive as possible without compromising the message. And what we found is when you give a short talk to stimulate questions on some of the biggest topics I think that are facing young people, they're ready to engage. And I'm actually quite hopeful. Though it is a post-truth world that elevates feelings and preferences over facts and truth, given the number of people, the sheer thousands sometimes, who come to these open forums and line up and skeptics ask their questions, I'm actually quite hopeful, because they're not just out to get you. They're not giving you zingers. They're asking hard questions, but they stick around and they want the answers. And judging by the conversations we have after, and the emails and the phone calls we have after with these very same students, and the number of them who are coming to Christ, I'm extremely hopeful.
So do you start with feelings and preferences, or maybe what does post-truth look like for apologetics today?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because you have to at some point address the fact that people have desire for what they want to be true, or if they want to ignore truth because of what they desire. And that's always a tough thing, because the questions are in fact changing. In many ways, 10, 12 years ago, this is how fast the culture changes. you know, the worldview that I inherited, or the cultural worldview I inherited when I graduated high school quite some time ago, is very different from the worldview my son will inherit when he graduates high school in just 4 years. What's interesting is that the worldview of the culture that my youngest daughter will inherit 4 years after my son will actually be different than the one he inherited. That's how fast things change. And so the questions become different. You know, it used to be the case that when you went to a college campus, they would ask you about science and faith issues almost exclusively, or doesn't the Bible have contradictions, or, you know, these kind of things, or, you know, can you reconcile for me how I don't see the resurrection really happening, and all these various things, miracle claims. They would ask more fact-based questions. Now, I won't say it's more feelings-based, but it is more meaning-based. They ask meaning questions. And the fact questions are there, but they try to lodge them in terms of their meaning issues. And I think we're in a culture that desperately wants meaning and tries to foist meaning upon us through our feelings as opposed to truth. And we need to bridge the truth and fact, the truth and feeling gap. We need to bridge that gap, and that's what we try to do.
Talk about it as a cultural confusion, and there certainly seems to be a great deal of confusion, you know, across the globe or across the whole spectrum.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wrote the book, actually, Saving Truth, was because I began to notice something, is that confusion started to become a virtue and clarity started to become a sin. When you think about it, if you're confused sexually and you admit it out loud, you're a hero. If you're confused morally, there are no moral boundaries and everything is sort of fluid, you're considered progressive. And if you're confused religiously, you know, all paths lead to God, so to speak, and no one has a lock on truth, well, you're considered tolerant. So you're heroic, you're progressive, and you're tolerant if you have these confused views. But if you're clear, you know, on sexual mores or sexual boundaries or even gender issues, you're considered a bigot. If you're clear on moral strictures, that there are certain objective moral values, and morality is not a progressive, evolving thing, but it's actually based on an unchanging, timeless creator, well, that's considered regressive. And if you're clear that there is only one way to God, well, that's considered intolerant. So if you're confused, you're a hero, you're progressive, and you're tolerant. If you're clear, you're a bigot, regressive, and intolerant. And that's what you find yourself facing all the time. And you have to sort of dispel these things carefully and deftly, but yet you do have to do it. And oftentimes it is these preconceived notions of Christianity that get in the way of the truth of the gospel. And our job, I think, is to dispel that. And that's why I wrote the book.
Well, maybe you can just give us a little foretaste or a little snippet, because as you said, in your faith journey, you ran into some Christians who really knew what they were talking about. We want to know what we're talking about and be more effective in our witness. So what would that look like today? We want to be clear, but we want to be full of grace as well.
Yeah, and I think the part of it is to take a look at ourselves, too. Are we the church sometimes acts in a very post-truth way. In other words, our preferences seem to matter more than the facts and the truth sometimes. So Christians have to be very careful as to how we spread things, whether it's on social media or whatever. Do we actually investigate the articles that support our position and make our quote-unquote enemies look bad, or do we just forward them on without thinking about them? That's one way we can actually gain credibility, is by being careful and people with the truth. But the other way is to listen to the questions of culture. So when I think about the questions of culture today, oftentimes it's on meaning and purpose. One of the leading causes, in fact, the leading cause of death, I think between 15 and 28 years old, is suicide. And that's because people are finding less and less meaning. Isn't it ironic that the more and more people are given whatever they want in terms of their feelings and their preferences, the less meaning they actually have and the less hope they actually have? So that's one of the issues. But sexuality, science and faith, and this sort of seeming dichotomy between science and faith, that the more science we have, the less we need faith. One of the things Christians can do to equip themselves is to realize that faith is not wishful thinking. Faith is not believing something without evidence or despite the evidence. Faith is actually trust. That's what the Greek word means. It means to trust in the one who has given you enough evidence to trust him in the first place. So I, as a Christian, trust in what God will do in my life and in the future of this country based on what God has done in the past and given me the wonderful evidence for the resurrection and the validity of the Bible. And he has shown me through the creation itself that he has created this world to purpose.
Good insight from Abdu Murray today. We're talking about his book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. He's also written the Grand Central Question. I recommend that to you as well. And Abdu, I know that there are many of your forums. You actually put them on webcasts so people could find out more. I mean, tell us a little bit about what we might see if we were to get online and watch one of those live events.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had a one at Yale, for example. Me, Robbie, and I did one at Yale University, and we had 800 or so in attendance at a smaller chapel. We had, I think, 180-something thousand watching it live on YouTube, which is amazing. Contrast that with Michigan State University, where we had 9,500 who were actually live, as well as the thousands watching online. What you'll essentially see is about a two-hour program that includes a talk, sometimes just by one of us, but sometimes we tag team. Robbie and I tag team. He'll do 20 minutes and I'll do 20 minutes. And we'll pick a topic of particular importance, like the post-truth culture. Can we know truth in a post-truth culture? Or where is God when it hurts? Or, you know, is Christianity bigoted? Something that's like a hot-button issue. And we'll give a short talk meant to stimulate questions. And then after the talk is done, we enter into a time of question and answer, and we'll usually have two microphones, and the students are invited to come up, and they ask their questions. No question is off limit, so long as it's actually a question and not a statement in the form of a question. We try to answer them as best we can. What you'll find, too, is that we try to get to as many questions as possible. We often will give longer answers to the questions because the questions are deep and meaningful, and we don't want to give sound bites. We want to give as much deep meaning as we possibly can. So we often see those questions. And sometimes at our open forums, we actually invite questions from the audience, and whether it's on Facebook Live or on some other social media platform. If they type in their questions once in a while, we're actually able to take those as well, not just the live ones, but ones that are tweeted in, texted in, or other means as well. But what we hope to show you is that the Apostle Paul's statement that we are to answer each person, not each question, but each person, we're hoping to show that.
You show it well, and Abdu, it's been wonderful just to talk with you today. Boy, just a lot to review. I took a bunch of notes. I'm going to have to go back and review, and I hope people will check out rzim.org, or you can go to Abdu's website, abdumurray.com, and to find out about his books, speaking and writing. And I look forward to hearing more from you, Abdu, and blessings to you as you continue to share so effectively and communicate the good news of the gospel.
Thanks so much, Neil. You too, and thanks for having me on.
Abdu Murray joining us today on the afternoon show with Bill Arnold. That's what it is. I know where I am. Glad to have you listening in. I want to encourage you to be with us tomorrow as well. We have more great guests ready to go. And again, if you missed any part of today's show or other past shows, you find it all posted online, the afternoon show at myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com.